This episode contains strong themes that some listeners may find distressing. The historical events in this show touch on the subjects of chronic illness, death, suicide, homophobia, sexual acts, drug use, and some explicit language.
The 1980s were important and trying times for Aotearoa. Many look back to this time for the fashion and the music, but it was also a period of bold protest and activism, political reform, economic disasters, and more. You may have learned about some of these events in school: the Springboks Tour, the Rainbow Warrior, Māori Language Act of 1987, all important parts of our history that people should know and reflect on. In this series, you'll learn something that isn't taught in schools, but it should be. A story that should sit alongside all of our most famous events in history, involving a group of brave people that Aotearoa should be immensely proud of. Perhaps it's a testament to how well they did that most don't know their names, but it's time to change that. This is Our Forgotten Epidemic, a six-part story about Aotearoa New Zealand's response to HIV and AIDS, and some of the many brave individuals who changed the course of history. I'm your host, Dr. Jason Myers, and I've been honoured to have been a part of the HIV response in Aotearoa for nearly two decades. This is part one, An Epidemic Arrives. In this series, you'll hear people using the language that we have to describe HIV and AIDS today. But we need to remember that both AIDS and HIV went through several names and levels of understanding at the time. The name AIDS was not used until 1982, and the name HIV wasn't in use until 1986. It's good to keep this in mind as you listen to this series. In the United States in 1981, five young men in Los Angeles were reported to be infected with a rare form of pneumonia. In the report, it was noted that they were all gay men, which seemed to be too much of a coincidence to not be relevant. This was the earliest sign of a new, mystery disease. Over the coming months, as more cases started popping up across the US, mainly in groups of gay men and injecting drug users, people were starting to get scared. In these early days, no one even understood what the cause of the disease was. The only thing that was known about it was that it was killing young, otherwise healthy people, and it was mostly spreading through marginalised and criminalised populations. No one knew it then, but these first deaths were the beginning of a new pandemic, one which would claim, at current count, tens of millions of lives worldwide. And at Aotearoa New Zealand, most never considered it would one day reach us. The first person you're going to meet is Bill Logan, born in Hutt Valley in 1948. Bill was a self-confessed radical activist. He left New Zealand in his 20s, travelling to Australia, the UK, the US and Southeast Asia. Bill landed back in Aotearoa in the early 80s and came out as a gay man, a brave choice at the time. He then returned to university as a mature student. Here's Bill.
Got back to New Zealand in early 1980. And enrolled to do postgraduate study in political science and taught political science. And it was there at university that I got involved as kind of the older of a generation of kids coming out.
It was at university that Bill and his friends started to hear rumours of an illness that was affecting gay men overseas.
We didn't know what it was or whether it would come to New Zealand or any, you know, but it was a bit scary.
In New Zealand, it was only the gay and rainbow media that seemed to be paying attention to this deadly illness spreading through gay populations overseas. In September 1981, a tiny column appeared in issue number 27 of Pink Triangle, the newspaper of the National Gay Rights Coalition of New Zealand. The headline was, "Gay pneumonia? Not really," says researcher. This unassuming column, the smallest, on a page filled with, at the time, more pressing issues of the injustices dished out against the gay community was the earliest mention of HIV and AIDS in a New Zealand newspaper. It would take another 2 years before the New Zealand mainstream media ran an article on this mysterious new illness in a November 1983 issue of the Christchurch Press. But even though the New Zealand media wasn't talking about it, community-led groups, like the one Bill was part of, were already gathering around the country. And the whispers they were sharing were scary.
There was something going on in America. People were dying, and no one knew quite why. And it was a variety of cancers and pneumonias, and no one knew why. And was it through just too much anal sex or, no one knew. But that didn't make sense, that explanation, because that had been going on for as long as the world.
The next person you'll meet, Dr. Rod Ellis-Pegler, is someone you're going to be hearing a lot from throughout this series.
I'm a New Zealander. I was born in Auckland, in Otahu to be precise, on the 6th of November 1941.
A lifelong fascination with animals and insects led Rod to begin a Bachelor of Science in Zoology at Auckland University. But like most young people in the first year, he had a change of heart.
I thought, well, maybe I could do medicine, and that's really how it happened. I applied for medicines at the end of that first year, but I got good marks and they accepted me into the medical school. The only medical school was in Otago, and down I went for the next year.
Once Rod had graduated from medicine at Otago University, he was faced with a difficult decision all doctors come up against at this stage of their career. What would he specialise in? By his own admission, he was drifting through medicine after med school. But after speaking to people at the hospital, he eventually made a choice that would see him placed front and centre to respond to one of the most devastating pandemics the world has ever seen.
You don't have to be Einstein to realise that someone who's got a great interest in zoology might end up in infectious diseases. But I didn't have a plan to be an infectious disease physician. But anyway, I decided in about 67 or 8, I think it was, that I would do infectious diseases. And I don't really know what made me make that decision.
But make that decision he did. Following this, Rod moved his whole family overseas to work in various infectious disease roles in both the UK and the US. In 1975, Rod brought the expertise he had gained overseas back to New Zealand. At the time, he was the only infectious disease physician in Auckland, and so he had a lot on his plate. Rod was busy modernising Auckland Hospital's outdated infectious disease ward, Ward 9C, when his colleague approached him for a chat.
So it was sitting across the road from the hospital, and I was going across the road, and I ran into the Professor of Pathology, Peter Herdson, and he said, "Do you read MMWR?
Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, or MMWR for short, is an epidemiological report released weekly by the US Centers for Disease Control, which is followed by medical professionals worldwide.
And I said, "Well, to be honest, I've got enough to read without it." He said, "Well, Rod, I think you really should, because there have been two articles which just look like they might have something to do with you in the end." So I went to the library, I read them for the first time, and was sort of a bit stunned by them. That's what woke me up to the fact that this illness now existed, and whether it became much bigger was unclear, but it sort of seemed a bit amazing, because the second one was sort of New York and Los Angeles people with Kaposi's sarcoma, and I knew enough about Kaposi's sarcoma to think, what? This sounds absolutely crazy. You don't get Kaposi's sarcoma like that.
Now, Kaposi's sarcoma is a particular type of skin cancer. The report on the MMWR was reporting that young men, in their droves, seemed to be developing this condition. It made no sense to Rod. Even so, after this conversation, Rod was so busy at the hospital that this new, as yet unnamed disease, largely only a problem in the United States, wasn't front of mind. He would deal with it when he had to, if he had to. Then he received a phone call, which signalled that everything was about to change.
I got a telephone call from Sydney, a fellow called David Cooper, who was an immunologist, and he rang me and said, look, we've got this guy who's a New Zealander. He's got this new illness. He wants to go home. He comes from Taranaki. He's absolutely dehydrated and wasted. He's really crook. It's a good New Zealand and Australian expression. I used to use the word the patient was crook. You know, he could be really crook or just a bit crook. And so I had a classification system for crookness. So David rang me and said, so we're putting him on an Air New Zealand plane. And we've got enough fluids into him for him to last as he gets over. And then can you somehow arrange to meet him at the airport and bring him in to Auckland Hospital and resuscitate him fluid-wise and then send him on down to Taranaki? And indeed, that's what we did. He came in and he was desperately ill from just continuing diarrhea and dehydrated. And so we IV'd him up a bit and 1 or 2 days later sent him down to his parents in Taranaki, who had not known, as was so often the case in the early days, that he was gay, much less had AIDS. And he died very quickly, and I think was the first person to die in New Zealand with AIDS.
We'll come back to Rod shortly. In the meantime, I want to introduce you to Bruce Burnett, a close friend of Bill Logan's. Bruce was born in 1954, in the suburb of Avondale, on the edge of Waitakere, West Auckland. A bright boy, charismatic and intelligent, with dark, lovely, curly hair, he went to Avondale College, studied architecture at the University of Auckland, before moving to Europe where he studied cuisine. Back in New Zealand, Bruce became involved in a few restaurants and cafes, notably the Just Desserts Cafe in Parnell, which he started with a friend, Christine. With Bruce's excellent cooking skills and natural charm, the cafe proved to be a hit. Even so, in 1982, Bruce started to get restless. Like so many other gay men throughout the years, he soon found himself pulled towards the bright lights of San Francisco, USA. Once there, Bruce began volunteering as a counsellor for the Shanty Project, a volunteer-run organisation that was set up to provide support for people living with life-threatening illnesses. Although initially emerging with a focus on cancer, when the AIDS crisis began, the Shanty Project quickly became a key provider of support and care for those affected. Group members went on to become key figures in the fight against AIDS, forming foundational groups such as ACT UP and drafting the Denver Principles, a set of ideas that spawned a self-empowerment movement for people living with AIDS. Then, in November 1983, Bruce made an abrupt decision to move back to Aotearoa. Living at his sister's house in Massey, he began connecting with friends like Phil Parkinson, a writer for Pink Triangle.
Now, at that stage, Bruce Burnett returned from the United States, where he'd been working in San Francisco. When he arrived, as I was doing the health round, I worked with Bruce to make sure that we got appropriate information into Pink Triangle.
As a writer for the same paper, which was one of the first to mention AIDS in New Zealand, Phil had followed and written the news report since 1981.
And there were a number of health-related issues in the air at that time. Hepatitis was one. STDs were also an issue. And we were becoming aware of the start of the epidemics in America and elsewhere. And as I was reading the gay press, because we had exchanged copies from gay papers from all over the world, I was following the AIDS crisis as it was developing.
But Phil didn't just write articles. He also used his knowledge to personally convince those around him that they needed to pay attention to what was coming. One of those people Phil decided to convince was Bill.
Phil Parkinson was working closely with Bruce Burnett, and he was keeping up with the literature on HIV/AIDS as it was coming out. And a lot of material was being published in something called the New York Native, which was a periodical and set in New York. And he would keep me informed. he had a connection with Bruce Burnett and essentially recruited me to take HIV seriously. I guess I wanted to be in denial, and Phil didn't allow me to be in denial and made me take it seriously. And I think that Phil knew that I was the most politically competent person likely to be interested in the subject, and that they needed a political type person in the mix to advance the work.
After reading some of the material that Phil would pass to him, Bill Logan was convinced something needed to be done. But what? Bruce, who by this stage had been back in Aotearoa for a few months, had a few ideas. The Ministry of Health wasn't doing enough to get ready for what was coming. The gay community needed to be warned, prepared and supported. And they, as gay men themselves, with their combined experience, were perfectly placed to do so. So on the 1st of June 1984, following a national seminar on AIDS, Bruce Burnett, Phil Parkinson, Bill Logan, Ray Taylor, alongside others, set up the AIDS Support Network. They quickly set to work, educating and enlisting people from all over the country. You've met Bruce, Phil, and Bill. Now let's meet two other key players who saw what Bruce was doing and wanted to join the movement. Kate Leslie met Bruce in August 1984 when he was giving a lecture at Auckland Hospital.
My friend who did the sexual health clinic at Auckland, who was a venereologist, said, oh, we're having someone who just come back from America come to talk about HIV and AIDS. You might like to hear that.
A medical social worker with a deep understanding of the New Zealand health system, from their first meeting it was clear that Kate and Bruce had instantly made a connection.
So it was their monthly gathering. So I went along, and there was Bruce Burnett, and he talked. And at the end of it, we chatted, and he said, I know all about HIV and AIDS, and you obviously know all about the health system. Could we work together? And that was the rest of my life for the next 4 years.
And also Tony Hughes, a scientist, researcher, and an advocate who has since been awarded a Queen's Services Medal for services to the community.
I was interested in prevention of HIV, what caused HIV, the science of HIV, how you took the science and communicated it to people so they would actually take care to not acquire HIV.
All four of these people were drawn to Bruce, who had seen the spread of the illness in San Francisco and lived through the deaths of many. Bruce knew they needed to move quickly to prevent the same loss here. Here he is being interviewed, talking about the impending need for swift action.
I think we'll see some cases within the next few months in New Zealand. We definitely have the virus here that was proven by the antibody tests done in Auckland. Some of those people do have mild forms of AIDS, but it also is important for us to let people know that this is a serious problem and that it is happening in New Zealand, and I think we will have cases very definitely in the next few months.
Meanwhile, over at Auckland Hospital, they too were realising the need to move quickly. Here's Dr. Rod Ellis-Pegler again, the zoologist turned infectious diseases expert.
We used to have a Department of Medicine meeting, sort of lunchtime meeting every Thursday. So we were at this meeting, and the business of, it wasn't even called AIDS then, as the numbers started to come out of the United States, people began to realise this wasn't just a nothing much that was going to disappear. The professor of medicine, I mean, just suddenly said out of the blue, what's happening with all this gay men in America with this illness? What if this happens here? What are we going to do? All the heads swiveled around and sort of looked at me. And I said, well, I guess we'll cope in 9C. It's looking like it's going to be an infection. We didn't know then. And so I said, yeah, okay, well, the infectious disease unit will do that. And that was just me at the time. There was no one else at the beginning.
In the 80s, AIDS went through a series of names as the medical community and those affected by it were scrambling to understand what was happening. In these early days, there wasn't even a conclusive test to diagnose infection. Instead, people were being diagnosed based on symptoms and postmortems. The early names, like GRID, gay-related immune deficiency, and gay compromise syndrome, were overly focused on gay men and were misleading. Some names, like gay plague and gay cancer, weren't only misleading, they were frankly offensive, discriminatory, and cruel. It wasn't until 1982, once it had become clear that this illness was not solely affecting gay men, that a new name was coined.
82 into 83, I think it was then that they recognised the first infected individuals in haemophiliacs, and that's, I think, when the penny really dropped and people said, this is just like hepatitis B, this is an infecting agent. I mean, everyone was sort of talking in that sort of way anyway, but I think that's when it really, that there's nothing else that explains this.
It was only by realising that the illness was also affecting haemophiliacs, people living with a rare condition that affects the blood's ability to clot, that scientists understood something. Acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, AIDS, was caused by a pathogen, the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, that travelled in the bloodstream from an infected person to someone else. At this stage, effective treatment was still a far-off dream, but prevention was possible. As you may have already guessed, though, educating New Zealanders about the truth of AIDS seemed almost impossible. Bruce, alongside the AIDS Support Network, understood the need for clear messaging. They set out to educate healthcare workers, politicians, and government figures, and perhaps most importantly, an ignorant, scared, and ill-informed public. One of the first things they did was set up an AIDS hotline where the public could call to access information and support. This telephone counselling service would become a valuable resource for New Zealanders. It played a part in supporting hundreds, if not thousands, of Kiwis affected by HIV and AIDS. It would field calls from the media, and as we'll hear, was pivotal on the front line when it came to welcoming people home. Kiwis are famously well-travelled, and the great overseas experience has always been an essential part of our culture. Especially for young gay men, and especially in the 80s, it was a way to get out of our little corner of the globe and find a big gay world in places like London, San Fran, Berlin, and New York. While overseas, gay men were being introduced to a different way of life, one in which their sexuality was something to be embraced and celebrated, rather than hidden and ashamed of. However, these same Kiwis were now coming home sick and dying, and were being ostracised and feared by their own communities. Here's Kate Leslie discussing a conversation she had with Bruce.
We talked, and he talked about the programme that they'd had in San Francisco to train people to help those with HIV and AIDS. And of course, at that time, if you had HIV and were going to get AIDS, you were going to get dead. And so it was an air. At that very stage, we probably didn't have any cases, but young men were coming home to varying levels of acceptance. Some came home to find that, no, they were welcome in the little town that they came from, because what would happen to father at the bowling club or the RSA with them around? With Kaposi's sarcoma, or there were religious clashes with people who had firm views about sexual orientation, and they were not welcome home.
Now, from the beginning, it was easy to see that discrimination and stigma would be a big issue in the fight against HIV and AIDS on our shores. An infectious disease threatening to spread through criminalised, necessarily secretive communities that already experience judgment and persecution is a catastrophe waiting to happen. We'll dive more into this side of the story in a future episode. But for the meantime, what we need to understand is that these were marginalised communities getting sick with what was often a physically visible, infectious disease. This meant that it wasn't just physical support and nursing that people with AIDS would need. The AIDS Support Network needed to train volunteers to be educators, to be counsellors, to be carers. Because who else would provide these services? In the early days, before there were many Kiwis living with AIDS, the focus was really on getting ready, educating people and pushing the government to act. Once things began to escalate, the AIDS Support Network would need to put their own advice and information into practice in a very public way. Here's Bill Logan talking about being back on the phones.
Someone contacted me, who was on the switchboard, and said, look, there's someone arriving tomorrow who's got HIV, and we've got to find somewhere for him to live because his parents are scared. And the medical officer of health is worried.
The media, who had been anticipating a case of AIDS in New Zealand, went wild. Bill had to call on his previous knowledge, which, as you'll remember, is exactly why Phil Parkinson brought him on board, to calm things down.
And the press got hold of the story that the guy was arriving, and we had to deal with the press and calm that down. I had a certain amount of experience with dealing with the press, and actually by being honest, but saying, look, you know, you can't go into people's private lives. No? So I can't give you the name of someone who's sick. You don't want to anyway, you couldn't publish it. And then we had to deal with the gay community and say that there's no problem, that someone has arrived in Wellington with HIV and he's fine and not a problem. And to try and calm everything down. Just to deal with madness.
Now, as well as discrimination faced by an uninformed and frightened public, the newly formed AIDS support network was fighting a battle on another front. Overseas, the epidemic had been allowed to run rampant, and people were already dying en masse. The AIDS support network thought that could be avoided here, but for that to happen, they needed to get the Ministry of Health to take this situation seriously, and that needed to happen quickly. Here's Bill Logan again.
And so Bruce and I went to see the Minister of Health and said, no, we think we better set up an organisation to do this job, which is an urgent job. The Minister of Health said, oh, yes, I think that's fair enough, but it's really not a big job at all because, after all, it's only a very small group of people who are into very minority kind of gay activities who are affected, people who are into whipping each other and things like that, isn't it? And I could see Bruce about to explode in a temper that no one had been taking any notice. And I said, quiet, Bruce. It's okay. Don't worry. I said, no, I think you've got to go and talk to your officials. It's actually a much bigger thing than that. And this is a very, very significant problem.
It was times like these that Bruce was unfortunately proved right. He had quickly identified the prevalent attitude in New Zealand at the time, the it couldn't happen here, and that sort of thing only happens in America. And he knew he had to force people to open their eyes to the reality that was coming, and quickly. Because AIDS definitely was going to affect New Zealand, and Bruce perhaps knew this better than most. But he had hope that maybe, with enough preparation, some of the tragedy that he'd seen on distant shores could be averted at home.
We got a telephone call from one of the big liners in Richard Ports of Auckland, one of these monster vessels.
That's Rod Ellis-Pegler again, our infectious diseases expert, talking about New Zealand's second known case of AIDS.
And they rang the hospital and we got put through to us, and this chap had this new illness and he was vomiting blood and they didn't really want him on their boat. So we said, okay, we'll take him up here and sort him out, which we did. The ambulance, up he comes to the ward him, and he's covered in Kaposi sarcoma. He may well be the most Kaposi sarcoma person I ever set eyes on, and I saw an awful lot of it, I can tell you. Anyway, he was right up there and he was vomiting blood, and we didn't know whether that was infective or not, but we made an assumption that it would be. We transfused him and he was around for a few days, and I could see him in my mind's eye. He was got completely improved and was dressed, and he was very dapper. They must have sent his clothes up when they were very dapper sort of dressing. He was a gay man. I think he might have been a lawyer even. Anyway, he was sort of taking his last trip on the planet to spend his money, and he, I think, flew back to New York.
While the media in Aotearoa would later develop fairly responsible reporting around AIDS, reporting of the first few cases was problematic, and this was creating a lot of issues, particularly for those personally affected. Here's Phil Parkinson talking to Bruce on an Access Radio broadcast about the issue.
The Auckland Hospital in the last week has had to deal with two rather unexpected cases of AIDS. There's been a lot of conflicting information about these cases in the media. How well did the Auckland situation develop? How well did Auckland Hospital cope?
Very well, I think. We have a really good relationship with most of the medical personnel in Auckland Hospital. They offered our services to the people concerned, and those people chose to get us involved. I don't want to say too much about this particular first case because we do want to guard their confidentiality, but I think we were of help to them, and the hospital coped pretty well. The guy off the QE2...
The QE2 Bruce is referring to here is the Queen Elizabeth II, an ocean liner at the time.
We've been involved with him and giving him lots of support, and he's really been grateful. Obviously, being so far away from home, it's not a very good situation for him, and he's really appreciated us being able to come and visit him and give him support, and also to be able to keep the media away. The media has been very interested in trying to get a story or interview with him, and he really just wishes to be left alone and just to quietly slip out of the country and go home.
You can hear in Bruce's voice that he really cares for the people who are affected.
There has been, in relation to the later case, a lot of concern expressed by the liner and the police about dangers to public health. Was there any basis to those fears at all?
None whatsoever. The guy in question was diagnosed quite some time ago in the States with the disease. He has a disseminated form of the Kaposi sarcoma, which doesn't respond to treatment. He was basically taking a final cruise. It was unfortunate that he had some problems that needed hospitalisation when the ship was near New Zealand. Otherwise, he would have probably completed the cruise without any problems.
Bruce and the others at the AIDS Support Network had a focus on clear messaging and straight to the point, sometimes shocking for the time, language.
He's a very responsible individual. I shouldn't have to say this, but I will say it quite categorically that he has not exposed anyone through any sort of sexual or other contact. And I've been concerned that there's been all this story about and worry about this particular sort of individual when we should really be much more concerned about people in the community who at the moment probably are contagious, probably don't know they're infected. These are the sort of people that we do need to worry about, not the confirmed cases, not the people who we know and we have contact with and who we are monitoring and we know are being responsible.
Public health, sometimes referred to as the science and art of preventing disease, is an extremely complicated interdisciplinary field. In New Zealand, we have medical officers of health, doctors, chosen by the Director General of Health, to make choices that are in the best interests of managing, promoting and maintaining a high level of public health in their communities. At this time, Dr. John McLeod was Auckland's medical officer of health. He recognised Bruce's contribution and value, and so John employed Bruce as a way of ensuring he was able to continue his mission. With his paycheck, Bruce decided to embark on a one-man roadshow across the country, determined to educate, prepare, and mobilise people while there was still time. Meanwhile, Dr. Pegler was also giving talks around the country, even though it wasn't exactly part of his job as an infectious disease doctor.
I kept strictly to the science as we knew it, because I became very quickly the sort of leading medical person to be talking to. And I developed a public role in terms of talking about it. And I talked up and down the country to all sorts of groups, from jail wardens to police and ambulance people and concerned mothers in Timaru and this sort of all over the place. Though I wasn't part of the public health response, I was employed by the Auckland Hospital Board to look after sick people.
Bruce decided, now that people with AIDS were actually arriving home to New Zealand seeking medical care, that it would be useful to work together with the medical teams who would be responsible for treating them. This is how he came to meet Rod Ellis Pegler over in Ward 9C.
He had seen people, and to use his own words, friends dropping like flies, that was his language. But he was also a straight shooter, and he really wanted to talk to me, and he just rang me up, I think, and said, I want to talk to you about what's going on. And because I don't know I knew what was going on, but he said, I've actually seen it. I said, well, come on up and we'll have a yarn. And my office was on the 9th floor of Auckland Hospital, and Bruce came up and talked to me about it, and he wanted to do things. And I don't know, I guess I helped him with the sort of people he needed to see.
Bruce and Rod quickly grew to be friends. Although Bruce continued on with his work in the gay community and the AIDS support network, and Rod stayed firmly in the realms of medicine and outside of any movements, a relationship of respect, collaboration and trust was established. Now, alongside everything else Bruce was setting in motion, the AIDS support network, the hotline, the one-man roadshow, liaising with the media, negotiating with the Ministry of Health and other government officials for more money and more support, he also did something that required incredible, unthinkable bravery. In a time when homosexual acts were illegal and homosexuals could be openly discriminated against, a time when people were terrified and intelligent people were acting completely irrationally, Bruce came out. But he didn't just come out as a gay man, he also came out as a person with AIDS.
Bruce continued from his position there to speak on radio and television, to speak to groups. He was a very charismatic, engaging, delightful man, and people warmed to him, were engaged, supported his courage in being out and speaking about himself and issues, and they admired his bravery. So a whole lot of people who might have been otherwise standoffish and not supportive here, Bruce was able to net in by virtue of his personality and his commitment to the work, that he was plain about his sexual orientation, that he was an honest person and waging and engaging people. People had, you know, the media information about HIV/AIDS. One of Bruce's major things was the terror management, because people were just so frightened and had all sorts of fears and worries and bogies and extraordinary things. What was our task was to get the facts clearly and present them. People had notions that HIV was floating through the air, or you were going to catch it from cups and saucers or shaking hands or the swimming pool or food, whatever, and we needed to one by one dispel all these things. And Bruce was very good and plain at doing that, and travelling around and talking to gay men and encouraging them to change their behaviour. But of course, bit by bit, I mean, the immense efforts he made told on his health.
Although Bruce was exceptionally good at terror management through his natural honesty, charisma and plain speaking, he and the people working closely with him weren't always able to avoid the judgment that came with being known as a person with AIDS. Here's Phil Parkinson talking about a particularly heartbreaking moment which highlights this public stigma.
I was in a meeting and there was a circle and everyone was putting their arms around each other, and one person on one side of me and one was the other on the other side, and there was a gap, and Bruce moved into that gap. And the person on the other side couldn't quite bring himself to touch him. So the solution to that was, once I recognised that was the problem, I moved on to the other side. And the chap, who is a very, very nice man, realised that that was the case, and he coped quite well, in fact. But for a lot of people, that first encounter of being in the same room as a person with AIDS was quite scary.
And it wasn't just ignorant people acting in this way. There was one story about a doctor who really should have known better, boiling the china for 15 minutes after Bruce had used it. Here's Kate Leslie, who travelled closely with Bruce.
I know people destroyed the china times if we'd been to visit. People just were terrified of it. He used to say to me, you should be very careful. You spend a lot of time with those people. You've been eating and drinking, and you should be very careful. And I said, oh, Bruce used to be a chef. He cooks beautifully. He cooks the food and I eat it. Such was people's fear. I remember one very good friend of mine, a multi-degreed woman, and we were going to stay with her because she wanted to write an article about Bruce. And I think probably the day before we were going, she rang and said, I can't do this. I can't believe I'm saying this. I don't understand myself, but I couldn't have him in the house. And so this was the level of fear that people had. And although part of them might know this was not rational, they were not able to overcome that.
It's hard for us to imagine today how Bruce and all those other people living with AIDS must have felt to have been treated this way. But Bruce didn't give up, with a unique determination that only seems to come along every so often in a few great people. Bruce kept leading the way. He was one of the first people in New Zealand to openly admit to being infected with HIV publicly. To do that required enormous courage and integrity. Importantly, Bruce recognised that AIDS needed a human face to it, someone who was relatable, down to earth, a good Kiwi bloke. He could have been your best mate, your neighbour, your colleague, or your brother. Rod Ellis Pegler remembers the day Bruce told him about his HIV infection.
Bruce Bennett. It's funny how it's still a bit raw, isn't it? I tend to just suppress it, really. There's no point. But anyway, here I am talking about it. Bruce Bennett, well, I can really see him in my mind's eye so easily. He had the courage that we grew to be friends. And then all of a sudden he said, look, he came up, he said, I want to see you today. I think I'm crook.
In 1984, Bruce Burnett, Bill Logan, Phil Parkinson and others set up the AIDS Support Network, which started out an informal grassroots movement run by volunteers. On the 18th of March 1985, a trust deed was signed, making the AIDS Support Network an officially recognised charitable trust, which meant that finally they were eligible for desperately needed government funding. What started as an informal group of concerned individuals from different walks of life had become an official organisation. They'd already achieved so much, but now, with help of this funding, they were ready to complete the journey they'd started. The organisation they'd built embodied the passion and determination of their unofficial leader, Bruce Burnett. The brave man who saw what was coming for his community, who had seen the need for gay men to work together to build a world that didn't relegate them to the shadows, who tirelessly, while incredibly ill, set in motion a chain of events helmed by a group of people who would forever change the face of public health here in Aotearoa. The first of this government funding, $100,000, was received in April 1985. And less than 2 months later, on the 1st of June 1985, at the age of 30, Bruce Burnett died.
He died incredibly quickly, just a few weeks. All those years ago, he said, I'm crook. And he said, can I come and see you as a doctor? Because I hadn't had that role with him to that time. And yes, he was. He had a paralysis of a nerve in this part of his face, which I knew was incredible. It's a very rare event, incredibly powerful predictor of his having a lymphoma in his meninges, in his spine. And indeed, that's what he had. And we agreed that he was untreatable. There were no drugs for HIV infection. You can treat lymphoma, but the thought of treating someone with his HIV, as we now know it, induced immunity with lymphoma drugs was quite impossible. Well, it wasn't even HIV then when Bruce died. But he knew, I think we were probably calling it AIDS by then, whatever. Yeah, no, I told him that day. I said, look, as you know, Bruce, shit happens, mate, and that's happened. He said, well, it doesn't surprise me. I expected it to happen. He was quite accepting. It's not a very good word, is it? But people do accept things when there ain't no wriggle room.
Thanks for listening to Our Forgotten Epidemic, a show about Aotearoa New Zealand's response to HIV and AIDS.
and some of the many brave individuals who changed the course of history. Burnett Foundation Aotearoa is proud to be able to tell part of this important story from the perspectives of some truly remarkable people. And we want to acknowledge there's so much more than we can tell in this short series. Our Forgotten Epidemic was produced by Wavelength Creative in collaboration with Burnett Foundation Aotearoa. Written and researched by Alyssa Partington, Matt Bain, and myself, Jason Myers. All music composed by Alex Cox. Many of the voices you've heard in this episode are from a series of interviews conducted by Dr. Cheryl Weir in 2019 for the New Zealand AIDS Foundation Oral History Project. Thanks to Pride NZ for allowing us to use portions of an interview with Kate Leslie. You can listen to this interview in full, alongside many others, at pridenz.co.nz. The audio featuring Bruce Burnett and Phil Parkinson is from the Gay Broadcasting Collective Wellington, held at the Lesbian and Gay Archives of New Zealand, Te Pūranga Takatāpui o Aotearoa, Legans. Special thanks also goes to Peter Davis for his excellent book, Intimate Details and Vital Statistics, AIDS, Sexuality and the Social Order in New Zealand. To make sure you don't miss an episode of Our Forgotten Epidemic, be sure to subscribe to or follow the show in your podcast app. And while you're there, leave us a 5-star review. It really helps others find the show. I'm Dr. Jason Myers. Join me in the next episode of Our Forgotten Epidemic.